Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the On Air podcast. We hope that you didn't miss us too much during our couple of weeks off. It might be a bit of a shorter episode today because my internet's still getting installed. So, I'm not having the best access at the moment. So we're going to try and not talk for too long, but knowing us. And of course, we're going to be talking about the big royal story that has just recently happened, which is a royal wedding, which everyone loves. Yes. We're going to be talking about the wedding of Crown Prince Hussein of Jordan, who is the son of the King and Queen of Jordan, and his now wife, Rajwa Al Saif, which happened on the 1st of June. You can go back and listen to episode 35 if you want to find out about their engagement. We talked about that then.
And it's like, it's a weird wedding because Hussein is significantly younger than the other heirs, but also significantly older than the heirs. So, you know, when everyone's like, oh, we've done all the heirs' weddings, everyone was like, oh no, we still have Hussein. But then even though Hussein's done it, it's not the start of the next batch yet. He's just like the middle child.
Well, I think if you go back and listen to episode 35, so we know that Rajwa is a Saudi Arabian architect. We didn't know they were even dating until the engagement was announced. It was definitely a surprise for everybody. I think a lot of us have thought maybe in a few years he'll get married. We'll hear about a girlfriend before then. But no, it was just like, bam, he's getting married. Earlier this year, we had the wedding of Hussein's sister, Princess Iman. And so we had, I think, a little bit of an idea what to expect from this wedding, which we might not have had before because it's actually been quite a long time since we've had a Jordanian wedding. Or like a big one anyway. There's a million and one family members, but they tend to be quite low-key weddings. I think that gave us a bit of a head start in terms of kind of knowing what to expect. Obviously, it was going to be slightly different because he was the heir to the throne and Iman's just a princess. But we kind of had a little bit of an inkling of what to expect. And I just like to say, I love the Jordanian approach to weddings, like the build-up to the weddings before we even get into the actual wedding itself. Basically, they tell you like a week before or 2 weeks before they're going to get married on this date, and then you hear nothing else.
That's all you're getting.
All you're getting. You're lucky to be getting that. I'm used to the British approach, which is tell you something, then tell you nothing for 4 months. And then when they do tell you information, it is nothing that you're interested in, like the chair that the Bishop of Norfolk is going to be sitting on. Like, I don't care about that. I want to know if they're going to wear tiaras. So they don't tell you anything useful. And to be honest,
I felt like the last big wedding was Harry and Meghan's, and like my main memory of the build-up for that was just like no information and then them being like carriages,
yeah,
and that was it for ages. And I was like, just don't tell me anything. If you're gonna tell me about carriages, tell me nothing.
But yes, no, I completely agree with you. Like, I don't need to know the name of the person or the horse that's pulling the carriage. I don't need to know the chair that a bishop is sitting on. I think my view, I've learned, is if it's important, I'll find out.
Yeah, someone will tell me if it's a really key fact.
Yeah, like, I'm not going to the wedding, so I don't need to know where it is, really, do I? Like, I understand it's different in Jordan from, like, the UK, but I didn't need to know where it was. I only needed to know the date and the time, and that was pretty much everything. I think I found out where it was going to be live streamed, like, an hour before.
It also means that when you're watching the wedding, you're kind of like experiencing it in real time. Like, oh, that's a fun fact I've just learned, rather than being like, oh, I already actually knew that the Bishop of Norfolk was in that chair, you don't need to tell me. I know these things. So it does make it kind of like, I don't know, like when you were, I always remember when I was younger and I was watching like Doctor Who and there'd be a surprise return, and I was younger and I was like, whoa, I had no idea that was going to happen. It blew my mind. Whereas now I'm older and I see spoilers, I'm like, I knew that was happening. And it kind of is more that like, whoa, that's such a nice, exciting, interesting factoid I did not previously know, which just makes it a little bit more exciting than being like, I've actually known that information for 6 months. So improve your facts, BBC News.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree. So I am fully on board with this Jordanian system. I mean, apparently when I spoke to friends of mine, they said it's quite a common sort of Muslim thing for Muslim weddings to kind of just not tell anybody anything. I think it's maybe a superstitious thing, So they weren't surprised that they, I mean, with Iman's wedding, it was even worse. It was literally like the week before we found out they're going to get married next week, by the way. This one, we did have a little bit more announcements in advance because of who was coming and things like that. But yeah, no, I'm a big fan. Yeah, I think we did find out some things, but that was mostly through kind of other royal family. So we started to get news about who was going to be in attendance from different royal families. And I think, it was definitely ended up being bigger in terms of the attendance than I thought it was going to be. You know, when it was just announced that they were engaged, I kind of was thinking, well, we'll maybe have some close royal families that they're, you know, they have a good relationship with, like Spain and then the other Middle Eastern royal families and things, but I didn't expect like everyone like we got.
Yeah, I think both of us, we were like, well, if you look back at, you know, Abdullah and Rania's wedding, there was no one there. And then someone quite rightly was like, yeah, but if you look at the last Crown Prince wedding, a lot of heirs were there. And I was like, oh, yeah. Kind of forget that there was, because I was so used to being like, well, like, Hussein is Abdullah's, you know, Crown Prince. Abdullah wasn't the Crown Prince. So we just had no reference points when actually there was other Crown Princes we could have just looked at. But yeah, I was quite vocally like, no one's going. It is perhaps going to be Juan Carlos and that's it, and Qatar maybe. And yeah, I was proved very wrong because everyone went.
There was some funny things going on sort of in the day before, because the only royal family obviously who didn't confirm their attendance in advance, because this is what they're like, were the British royal family. And so it was very funny, like, I don't know where people find out this information, but there's people who do flight tracking and they were like, oh, a plane has left from RAF Norfolk and it's an RAF plane or a government plane or something. So it must be carrying royals and this has happened. So it can't be a government minister. It has to be a royal. And everyone was sort of like sitting like, oh, is it going to be William and Kate? Is it going to be somebody else from within the family? Is it going to turn out to just be some like ambassador or something that nobody cares about? So yeah, that was sort of like going on the day before, of kind of people randomly watching the flight path to try and work out whether it was going to be William and Kate, which it was in the end, but it was very funny, I thought.
Yeah, it's like the flight wasn't going to like suddenly start spelling out William in the midair. Ooh. I was like, this plane will tell me. If I just look at this image for long enough, I'll figure it out.
I know, yeah, it was ridiculous. Yeah, like all the other families told us in advance, we knew they were leaving. There's pictures of Victoria and Daniel on their plane. But with William and Kate, we didn't even know until we saw like a grainy footage of them walking through a hotel in Jordan. So yeah, the kind of, I think the festivities almost started the day before because everyone was just sitting like, the people who run that website must be like, wow, that's a lot of traffic for a random flight from UK to Jordan. All these people watching this.
people from all over the world just randomly stalking this one RAF plane. First, it's suddenly security risk is going, hang on, it's a bit of an RAF issue going on. And it's like, nope, it's just a bunch of young women from around the world.
Oh, aren't we adorable? So the coverage started. I started watching it, I think maybe about an hour before anything actually started happening, because that's when I thought it began, but it didn't.
Yeah, me too.
I don't know which one you were watching. I was watching the Jordanian state broadcaster, so I guess like the version of the BBC in Jordan. And I didn't understand any of what was going on, obviously, because they were speaking in Arabic. But they did have a full-on dance party. There was like a guy who was performing loud, cheerful music, and all the presenters were standing up and dancing. And it just made me think, like, if they were doing the Jubilee and Fatboy Slim was in the studio and Hugh Edwards was standing bopping around in the studio at the BBC, it would not happen. It was much more cheerful over there.
Yeah, even if it did happen, we would complain about it for like the rest of time.
Well, some people would complain about it, like, oh, look at this, the standards of the BBC are dropping. Why is Fatboy Slim on the radio? You know, oh, he was the only DJ I could think of who was British. I'm sure there's like cool young DJs, but I was like, Fatboy Slim.
That's the point of reference here.
Yeah, I'm a 90s baby. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting anyway. Like from the very beginning, it sort of set it off for me that like, oh, this is going to be a slightly different wedding from the very restrained Church of England ceremonies that I'm used to, because even the coverage has the presenters up and dancing, which would never, you know, Hugh Edwards would never do that. And then we started to get into the actual meat of the wedding. And this is how I learned that Muslim royals love a receiving line.
Oh, they received everyone. We were all kind of, I think we'd all heard, I don't remember what time, like it was going to start at 2.
Yeah.
And then we'd all got there ready, like maybe at 1:30, everyone started to be like, oh, I'm watching the wedding. And then we all watched a variety of live streams and sat there until close to 2:30 before Rania and Abdullah, who were the first people who appeared, turned up.
Yeah.
And we were just like, I think it's over, it's running a bit late. Or as I like to think is that someone, one of their guests, is notorious for being late. So they were like, right, we're telling everyone it's an hour early.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they will be on time.
But they, so there's about 140 guests at the actual wedding bit, I think. And all 140 of those people went past Rania and Abdullah and they had to say hello and greet them and shake their hands. They had a lot of people to welcome. So there was obviously the bride's family. There was sort of diplomats and politicians from various countries. And then we had loads of royals. So we had royals from the UK, all of Scandinavia, the Benelux countries, Spain, Bhutan, Japan, Malaysia, then lots of the Arab countries as well. So I'm not going to go through every single one, but I will go through my biggest surprise, which was Princess Beatrice.
I know. Kate arrived and William, and we were like, oh, they're chatting for a really long time. La, la, la. Lovely, lovely, lovely. And then I glanced down for a bit and I think Mary turned up or something. I was like, oh, that's a nice outfit. And then I glanced back up. I was like, Beatrice? what is happening right now? I think I must have seen her coming as I was like flicking off to look at something else temporarily. And I was like, no, come back, load back up. I didn't know what's happening.
I was really surprised initially just because I figured that like this was going to be official sort of royal representation only, and so William and Kate were going to be like the representatives for the UK, and I maybe could have seen other people going to the reception part of it, but I didn't think that they would be at the actual wedding. So to see Beatrice show up was really surprising to me, and then I kind of thought about it a little bit more and I was like, actually Beatrice knows everyone in the world, like everyone. She's friends with Ashton Kutcher and like just the most random people in the world. And I, when I was looking into it, apparently Beatrice and her friends went to Jordan and got like a personal tour from Hussein. So I don't know if they have like met in previous occasions or if they just had a really nice time on that tour or what was happening, but they must be relatively close for her to get an invite to the smaller bit. It was only 140 people. That's not very much, even for a normal wedding. I think that's about average, yeah. You know? So I was both incredibly surprised and also like, no, of course, if anyone random was going to show up, it would be Princess Beatrice because she does just know everyone in the world.
Yeah, I think like, once I got past the initial surprise, it was like, oh, of course. And also kind of, I thought, you know, Beatrice and Hussein and, you know, some of the Greek royals were all kind of young, rich, wealthy, or single aristocrats at the same time. And I'm sure there is like a dating app like Raya just for aristocrats, and I'm sure at some point they were all like, oh, that's so funny, I saw you the other day, I did not swipe sus. But like I imagine there was a period of time where there was like a version of a fancy aristocrat group chat but was just for the singletons. Her husband is like incredibly wealthy aristocrat in his own right,
yeah.
So he was, I imagine he was also on the single dating website that I remember, which is how he met. I mean, I mentioned the whole thing here, but I like to imagine that this is a whole like, oh, of course we've got to invite Bea and Edo, our good friends.
Like the first sort of set of people who were arriving were all Jordanian royals, who at the time I didn't know who they were. I've looked them up now and I know who they are now. At the time I didn't. So they were just lots of random people. However, I will say that from like very quickly, it became apparent to me that like this was going to be a really great day for fashion because everybody just looked amazing. And I think it was a very different kind of dress code. Not in like an explicit way, but I suppose like I'm used to day dress for weddings and hats in the UK, but even like weddings like in Sweden where they wear gowns, it's sort of like gowns and tiaras and sashes. And this was a wedding that was in a very hot country, a predominantly Muslim country. And so there was a lot of like gowns that were obviously inspired by traditional sort of kaftan style things. There was lots of like earth tones, lots of really soft blues, soft pinks, lots of really floaty fabrics. There wasn't much that was kind of like stiff. And so like from the very beginning, I was like, everybody looks amazing.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, and I think everyone looked so good. And then all the dresses were like similar enough that it looked like very cohesive, but also they weren't all identical.
Yeah.
And there was a real mix of like smaller designers and then big Arabic designers and then like just their like go-to designer choice. It was like a really like good range and a good mix. And I think, you know, like as you kind of watch through, you'd be like dusty pink and then like, ooh, a pale blue, and it's like a really deep forest green, but somehow it worked because it was a nice flow of them. Like no one turned up in neon orange.
I won't go through every single person, but I mean, we can if you want, but I did have a couple of favorites. So one of my favorites was Princess Elizabeth of Belgium. We will post sort of links and things in the description, mostly because it was a cape. So
very pink.
Yes, it was a very sort of pink cape. It still worked. I think a floaty fabric was just really lovely. So that was one of my favorites. And then I think perhaps shocker, my other favorite was capes.
My favorite. And I didn't just mean that because it was Kate.
I thought this gown was really, really beautiful. Mostly, I mean, it was very pretty anyway, but I think one of the reasons I really liked it is that it felt very considered for this event. So from the colour that was kind of like a soft blush pink kind of colour, but with like a bit of brown, it's very earth tone-y, and the fabric, which is very soft. But then there was also this detailing on the bodice. It definitely felt like something Rania would wear, the Queen of Jordan.
Yeah, it did, actually.
Yeah, and I think when you looked at, if you sort of cut everyone's head off in the picture, not in real life, and compared, you would have said that that gown could easily have been worn on one of the Jordanian royal women. It looked like it would have fit in perfectly in their family photographs, whereas there were some other looks that are very pretty dresses. They've worn them before and I liked them, but like Crown Princess Mary's gown, to me, it stuck out as being very non-Jordanian. Like it didn't look like it fit with the event itself because it's quite a stiff fabric and it was very patterned and very crisp and white, and it just didn't really feel like it fit. So it wasn't so much, I mean, the dress was very pretty anyway, but it was particularly, I was fond of it because it felt like it fit in. Like she'd really thought about the occasion and what she was going to be, you know, the event and where it was going to be held and the weather and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely, as soon as I saw it, I was like, I love it. And then everyone was like, it's okay. And I was like, no, you're all wrong. You don't understand. This is a top two gown and it's not number two. It is the best thing she's ever worn. I absolutely loved it. Easily my favorite outfit she's ever worn. And I think
that's high praise.
I absolutely loved it. It was some of it was the colour. And I think she does like traditional princess looks really well. Like when she does go like princess, it looks really nice. And, you know, a pink gown with flowers is like proper princess. But I think, like you were saying, it was kind of like the whole look worked. Mm-hmm. Like another one of her outfits I really liked was the Alexander McQueen gown she wore when she was pregnant in Norway.
Yes, I
think, would I like that if, you know, it was altered and she wore it again, or she wore it to a film premiere? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I probably actually wouldn't.
No, not as much.
Really well for that exact moment in time, like for a you know, a dinner, walking in with King Harold, being, you know, very pregnant. It was a perfect for that exact moment. And I think this gown did the same thing. Like it was exactly perfect for the wedding of the Crown Prince of Jordan in Jordan. Like if it had been for, I don't know, when Princess Elizabeth of Belgium gets married, it's not going to be the right look.
Yeah,
and I'd be
sure.
Like, oh, weird outfit to wear in Belgium, Kate. But I think for this one, it was just absolutely perfect. And I was like, I love it. I'm amazed. It's the best thing you've ever worn. And then I was waiting all day. I was like, give me proper pictures because I cannot just look at these grainy photographs anymore.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Very happy when we got some proper pictures of that one.
But it was also by Elie Saab, who did a lot of the things for this wedding, as you'll see later on. and he's a very big designer for the Jordanian royals and for some others, and I know that there's a big contingent of Elie Saab supporters who absolutely think he's the best thing in the entire universe, so they would have been very happy. But I also think that it was a nice nod to like choose somebody who was Middle Eastern and somebody who is very popular with the Jordanian royals. That's why I feel like it could have been something that Rania would have worn easily. So yes, after all of the arrivals and all of the fashion, we had Crown Prince Hussein, who arrived first, obviously, and bless his little cotton socks. His expression on his face was, it was typical groom, I think, really. It was like a mixture of incredibly nervous, but really happy and like excited. And oh, bless his little, oh, he just looked so sweet.
I missed him arrive. And so I saw him and be like, oh, he's in uniform.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Hussein's there. He gave me solid Chris O'Neill vibes of like being incredibly nervous, but not because it's a wedding, but because it's like you're about to marry the love of your life. Yeah, excited.
Yeah.
But in this situation, whereas, you know, Chris O'Neill's a very nervous British person marrying, you know, a princess, he's the crown prince in this situation.
Yeah, what's he got to be nervous about?
But this is literally your house. Come on.
I don't know. I've never been married, obviously, so I don't know how it feels. So he arrived first. Then the bride arrived. Rajwa was escorted down the aisle by her future brother-in-law, or now brother-in-law, I guess, who Hashem, who is 18. So quite young, but anyway, he can walk, so that's fine. And she was also sort of had her two sisters-in-law now, Princess Aman and Princess Salma, as kind of maids of honor, I guess. I don't know what they call them, but that's what I would consider them to be, who were, can I say, from the very moment they arrived, incredibly diligent. They did not leave that dress until the last moment, making sure it looked absolutely perfect.
They were just sort of walking, and there's so many turns to get from like the entrance of the palace to the garden where the wedding was taking place, and they were just in gowns and heels, just like crouching, like throwing the dress this way, like drying it around the corner. They were on it. They were like, right, we've got a job to do and we are doing it.
Yeah,
like, this dress is never gonna look anything other than its best this entire order. After that, it's not our business.
Yeah, it's not
this moment. We're on it.
But it was very nice. I mean, I don't know exactly why it was Hashem who walked her down the aisle rather than one of her brothers. Not that it's a bad thing or anything. I just don't know if there's a particular reason for that, or if it was just like a, we really want to welcome you to the family sort of thing, and focus on sort of the fact she was becoming part of this family. I don't really know. But either way, I mean, I'm sure it was very special for all of them to be able to be involved in that, because it's their brother's new wife and she's very important, and, you know, sure, it was very nice.
And they do seem to have like Hussein's Instagram account, which does a very good job of doubling up as an official Instagram account and also a private Instagram account.
Yeah.
Is all, you know, there's a lot, he does a lot of pictures of like, you know, showy of pictures of Rajwa or of his siblings, and they all seem to get on really well. So even though I think, you know, for us we were all like, whoa, who is this weird woman just getting married? They were like, oh yeah, it's just Rajwa, obviously.
Yeah.
They're like big sister Rajwa already.
On to what she wore, which is obviously why everyone's listening. So she had, I'll start with the tiara. Let's start with that, because that's less controversial. Yeah. So she wore a new tiara, which we weren't sure she would. Queen Rania didn't wear a tiara for her wedding, so we didn't even know she would wear a tiara. And if she did, we didn't know if it would be one of Rania's or a new one, but it was a new one. It was actually very similar to Aman's tiara from when we talked about that in a previous episode. So kind of quite simple diamond, but it had some sort of calligraphy at the sides, some Arabic calligraphy, which we, I think, believe says her name. So yes, but it was very pretty.
It felt like the perfect midpoint between like Aman's wedding tiara and then the Arabic scroll tiara that Rania tends to wear, because it was the same. It was by Fred, who was a French jewellery man, brand
jeweler.
Sorry, not a very French name is Fred, but anyway, Fred made it, which is who made the Arabic scroll tiara. And it had that kind of sort of almost that sort of building up to that structure, but it was on the scale almost of slightly bigger version of Iman's tiara. And it was like, obviously she's the, you know, marrying the crown prince, so it, you know, slightly higher importance than Aman, who is just, you know, the princess, but it's part of the family, but it's not like a full-on in your face mega tiara. And it just seemed to be like a little scale of them, which is very sweet, right in the middle.
Yeah, because the Arabic scroll is massive. Now the gown, so the gown is by Elie Saab as well. So again, that's one of the reasons why I think Kate's dress was such a good choice, because she, I don't know whether she did this deliberately or not, but she ended up picking the person who designed the gown. We will post pics again, but I don't know, Grace, I don't know. So a lot of people were saying that the problem was that she wore flat shoes. It's notable that she wore flat shoes. And I'm going to be honest with you, if if Hussein either asked her to or made her feel like she needed to, because she's a tall woman and she probably would have been taller than him if she'd been wearing heels, that lowers him in my estimations quite drastically, because there were so many people when they were arriving where it was like these tall, beautiful, statuesque women and their short Jordanian husbands, and I was like, just go, you know, short kings, isn't that what the young folks say?
Yeah, short king,
you know. And Hussein is very, very handsome. I don't know why anybody needs to feel like he needs to be insecure about his height, so just embrace it, my dude. But anyway, that I don't think that's actually what bothered me. So I'm just going to say that outright, because I think a lot of people will be like, oh, it's the fact she didn't wear high heels. And like, I don't care. I actually thought that made her instantly more relatable.
I love the shoes. They were very simple and also looked very nice to wear, look comfortable, unlike every other pair of wedding shoes I've ever seen in my life.
I know, like I was, when I first saw it, I was like, I don't know if this is a traditional thing again, because I don't really know all these traditions, or if this is just her personal choice. But if she just wanted to wear flats, then instantly I like her even more, because yeah, I would want to wear flats. I can barely walk in heels at all. And on the biggest day of your life, you don't want to fall over or look wobbly. Like, I thought it was very sensible. so it was not that. I'm going to say that for me, the problem was not the flat shoes. My problem, I think, having thought about it very carefully for like 3 days, was that it felt like three dresses mashed together. So one of the dresses was the train, which I actually thought was beautiful, but it kind of looked like the train was attached to the back of the dress from like, it almost looked like petals that were kind of attaching it to the back. And it had a really beautiful design. I thought it was really gorgeous. The problem was it looked like a detachable train that had been attached to the back. It kind of reminded me of like when a little kid plays as a bride and they put a towel, you know, on the back of their jeans or whatever, and that's like the train of the dress. It kind of reminded me of like they just stuck it on.
I think it was detachable,
but the problem was she changed it for the afternoon or the evening. So why did she have a detachable train if she didn't ever detach it? It just doesn't make any sense to me. Anyway, so I think it would have looked better to me if the train had been integrated and as part of the gown. So that was one thing. I thought that was one dress. I thought the top of the dress, the main dress, was another dress. It was very nice. And I think when you saw her from the waist up, it looked really gorgeous on her. It was very kind of architectural, very sculptured. It had an asymmetrical neckline, which again, you know, she's an architect, that fits really well with obviously what she likes, and what we've seen her wear so far has been quite well made, sort of tailored, almost architectural, so it felt quite natural. But I didn't think it went with what was a very natural and organic looking train, with all these sort of petal details and floral details, almost like attaching it to a very architectural and sculptural dress. It didn't look like those two things went together. And then because the top of the dress, this sort of very structured bit, was so figure hugging, the bottom of the gown basically ended up having to be ankle length, because in the fabric that it was in and in the sort of tight fixture that it was in, or tight fit that it was in, if it had been any longer, I don't think she would have been able to walk in it practically. And so because of that, it felt like the dress was a little bit too short. And so we saw her flats more prominently. So it wasn't the problem that she was wearing flats. The problem was that we just saw too much of her feet in general, whether she'd been wearing high heels or flats. The way that the gown was, it couldn't really reach the floor. And so it made it look like she was just feet. And then some, you know, I just was very conscious of the fact that she has feet. And I didn't want to be that conscious of the fact that she has feet. So what I would say is that the top of the gown was also very pretty, but it just didn't fit with the bottom of the gown. So that was a separate dress. A third dress is the bottom. I just felt like two pretty gowns and then one basic gown that had all been mashed up together and didn't quite work in execution, if that makes sense. That's my current working theory.
I do agree. I think, you know, when I kind of first saw her from like the waist up, I was like, whoa, I love the, like, the, because the asymmetrical neckline, and it's all very like sort of crepe fabric and ruffly almost, but not a ruffle, like draped. I thought it looked, you know, she looked absolutely stunning, and it worked really well with the tiara. I was like, wow, we're going to be amazing here. And then actually, the more I looked at it, I was like, I'm not entirely sure an asymmetrical neckline works with full length sleeves. Because then you've sort of got a nice asymmetrical neckline, but it has to go back up into a full sleeve. So it does look a little bit odd. Whereas if it was symmetrical, it's even, because it does look a bit unbalanced. And I think because the rest of the dress is so sleek, it looks slightly unbalanced. Like, there's nothing to balance out the other side.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as you kind of saw the rest of it, like, I didn't see the front of her dress. I was like, oh, it's really sort of boring and just like a column dress, and it's like a simple one. And I was like, but she seems to have this massive thick veil. And then obviously they turned the camera around, and I was like, oh, it's a train. And I was like, okay, right, they are three different dresses, because the train is gorgeous, and the train wouldn't be out of place at any wedding ever.
That was beautiful.
And I went on Vogue Arabia and did some stalking, and you know, it had, like you said, it was like 550 like petals, but like fabric petals all attaching it, and it had beads and pearls and crystals all in this train, and it wasn't massively long like a Diana style, but it had emphasis, because it was like, yes, status, big train. But at first I didn't realize it was a detachable train, and I was like, how does it look like this train is not even part of the dress? Like, that's such a weirdly bad choice for something that's clearly very clever architecturally.
Yeah.
And it's not clever, it's just a detachable train, which is completely different.
Yeah.
I could not get my head around that for a really long time. I was like, how on earth have they managed to do this? Something so intricate, but so bad. But, and then like the veil was beautiful as well. And the veil went so well with the train. So it's almost like, you know, more than one person had very strong input on this dress, and someone wanted a flowing veil and train and the florals and the petals. And someone wanted the very sort of rigid, architectural dress, and it went, oh, let's just do both. But it didn't work doing both.
Because I think I understand, like, maybe she was going for that, maybe she really likes nature and being outdoors, and she really likes architecture, and so she wanted to incorporate these two things that she really likes in one gown. I'm sure that somebody could have, who's better at designing than me, could have come up with something that worked. But like the back of the dress, the petals that kind of attached to the back of the dress were really, really beautiful. But the ruching, the sculptural ruching that was on the bodice, had carried over to the back. So it looked like the petals were just like stuck on top of this very sculptured architectural bit. There was no like blend or moment where they came together. There was no like unity between the two. It was just like this petals attached to a dress that already existed. It didn't all quite work together for me. I think I've given it the score of 8 out of 10 for ideas and 4 out of 10 for execution.
I like that. That's not fair. Because, you know, I'm looking at it from the back now, and it's such a beautiful dress from the back. Mm-hmm. And that's really not what you want your wedding dress to be. I mean, I know guests actually do see the back of your wedding dress a lot, like compared to the front. But in your pictures, you look at the front more.
Yeah, and I think just too much foot. Yeah. Too much feet.
Too many feet.
I'm not a designer, I'm a critic. but that's, so it wasn't my favorite, but I think that's probably controversial, because a lot of people loved it.
I don't know if it's people to blame, but everyone went into this wedding and be like, the Jordanian royals always look really, really good. They have such good like taste in evening wear and gowns. And then not every Jordanian royal hit those high notes consistently.
Yeah.
So people were either like, no, that's awful, or were like, it must be good. Maybe we're wrong. Maybe we're blind and it's beautiful.
I do think that there's a certain element of the fact that Rajwa is tall and slim, has a lovely figure and is very beautiful. That kind of, I think this happens sometimes with like Mary or Letizia, and I'm probably guilty of it too, of like, if you put that exact same outfit on somebody who was a normal or like a average sized woman like me, people would not be as quick to be like, oh my god, it's the greatest thing in the entire universe. And I know that like fit matters and all that kind of stuff, but sometimes it is just a boring outfit that just happens to be worn by Gigi Hadid, so it looks really great, but it is just a boring outfit. And if you put it on anybody else in the world, it would look terrible.
It has to be quite overlap. I don't know anything about Rajwa, but like, she looks nice.
She looks nice, so she's my favorite royal now. There was a lot of that for this wedding. So then, yes, she arrived. And then we had the wedding itself. And once again, the Jordanians absolutely loving it. We spent about an hour watching the receiving line, watching all of the guests arrive and shake hands with Rania and Abdullah. The wedding was about 20 minutes.
in and out.
In and out. I didn't really know what was going on, obviously, because it was all in Arabic, but my friend, who is an Arab Muslim woman, she explained to me that basically, like, the two dads sit there with the couple, and they basically say, yep, yeah, we agree, they can get married, absolutely great. Then some witnesses sign a statement, and then it's done. And I think, you know, I'm used to Christian weddings, predominantly sort of Anglican or Church of Scotland weddings, and obviously Church of England and the British royal family, and obviously they have like hymns and they have readings and all that sort of stuff, and it goes on forever and ever. The actual wedding part of it is very short, but they do have all this stuff around it. There was none of that. And so I'm really appreciating the Muslim approach to weddings, because they just are like, let's skip the boring bit, the legal bit, and get to the fun where we get to have a party. And I really appreciate that, that attitude to life.
Yeah, I remember like when I watched Iman's wedding, and I remember being like, is this what all Arab weddings are? Yeah. Like, is this unusual? Is this like a special royal mini wedding? And they're like, no, this is just how Arab weddings are. And like, yeah, they can be longer, but they tend not to be. And I was like, ooh, do you reckon Hussein's will be longer because he's the crown prince? And everyone was like, no. And then it wasn't. And I was like, oh, I love it. Because I always think when you do watch a Christian Church of England wedding, they get married in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, they do.
And
yeah,
then they just sing bad hymns. I'm like, there are better hymns, if you're going to sing. But I'm always surprised when they're like, and do you take this? Do you? Yeah, brilliant, done. And I'm like, whoa, you can't be done. There is so much more of this stuff to go. Drag it out a bit. Come on, guys.
It's nothing. It's not a reflection on the couple themselves. I'm just going to say that. I'm sure that all of the people who have married have been very in love with each other, and that's great. But Church of England weddings do feel a little bit like joyless to me. It wasn't some bishop who's got a really boring, monotonous voice talking for 10 minutes about what love means in the Bible, you know. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I really like the fact that the Jordanian real weddings are outside.
Yes, it's gorgeous.
Most Arabic weddings are. Mm-hmm. And I was like right up until William and Kate got married, I was always of the mindset that if I ever got married, I would elope. Mm. And then after William and Kate got married, I was like, change of plan. I would like to be married in a cathedral, maybe by the Pope. I don't know. Ranking. And now, like, maybe an outdoor wedding is fine. I would take outdoors with some flowers. I would take that.
Very easily influenced, Grace.
I am. As soon as I see a pretty wedding, I'm like, I think this is my dream wedding. When I watch Don't Tell the Bride, and they're like, oh, I'm going to do an ice castle. And I'm like, I could get married in an ice castle. I could do that.
Yeah.
I also liked how Iman's wedding and Hussein's wedding were very similar. They were both outside weddings, but they both felt very like distinct and unique to each couple, which I think can sometimes be hard to do when you're
close together
in a garden in the same year, being brother and sister.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch Iman's wedding, but I'm going to trust you on that. But yeah, I totally agree with you about the outdoor thing. I actually said that to a friend of mine, of like, I know they can't do that in the UK, really, because most of them have to get married in a church for all these sorts of reasons. And some of the churches are really beautiful, don't get me wrong. Inside, they're absolutely gorgeous. But, you know, an outdoor wedding can be really, really beautiful. After the wedding became a little bit more shaky for me. My notes are like, some stuff happened, but I can't really remember the order that things happened in. So if we say something and it happened actually after something else, I apologize, but all these things did happen. It just happened in an order we can't remember. So there was, at some point, another receiving line that was after the wedding. And relatively early on after the wedding.
Receiving life.
Yeah. This one was with the bride and groom rather than Rania and Abdullah. But again, they had to receive the whole 140 people who were at that wedding. Most of it was just normal. Hello, you look beautiful. You had a nice wedding, blah, blah, blah. But there was some real bro hugs, which were really funny. So the one I noticed most was Prince William. I think there was a similar one with Sebastian from Luxembourg. But William was the first one. I think I've seen some GIFs and things of it, and I think you need to really see it in context, because I'll describe it to you here. Basically, Hussein had been greeting a few people by that point, and there had already been a few people who had gone by, and he'd obviously been very polite and cheerful and whatnot, but it had been very much like, I am a prince greeting people who I care about, but I'm still a prince. And then as soon as he saw William, it was like that whole thing dropped and he forgot who he was for a second. And he just like reached his arms out, the massive, massive arms to go in for a hug. And there was also sort of like a split second with William where I feel like he was about to go in as the heir to the throne of the UK and be very restrained and polite and cheerful, but, you know, professional. And then when he saw that Hussein had sort of initiated this big hug, like he dropped who he was and he forgot who he was for a second. And he just went in and returned the hug. And it was so funny. It was just like, for a second, it was just these two guys who were friends having a nice moment. It was very sweet.
It was so, you know, it reminds me of, we've seen like, candid paparazzi photos of like William and Mike Tindall hugging when they're out, and it felt like that, like two distant-ish relatives who see each other fairly regularly and get on a lot over rugby, be like, yeah, oh, you got married, hey,
yeah.
Except they both happen to be the heir to the throne of very different countries and very different cultures. This is so lovely.
I mean, obviously, so Prince William went to Jordan a few years ago and Hussein kind of hosted him while he was there. And there was a photograph that was released that is, I think, an all-time classic of William and Hussein watching the football together, just like in Hussein's house, which was not obviously an official engagement. It was just the two of them. And we don't get to see a lot of that. Like normally they stay in hotels or embassies and it's all very professional. And even if they stay in palaces, you don't get to see like, I mean, Mette Marit and Hakon have stayed with the Crown Princess couple of Sweden when they've gone to visit, but we don't get to see pictures of them having breakfast with Estelle and Oscar in the mornings and getting ready for a shower and stuff like that. It was very, very unusual to see something so relaxed. And I suppose Queen Rania is also on the Earthshot panel, so William knows her quite well. But I guess I hadn't really anticipated that they would be that close. They must have more contact. I guess we know that the Wales family have been to Jordan, so maybe they do see each other more often than we realise, because they genuinely did seem like friends. Like, he didn't greet members of his own family that way.
Yeah, I think, you know, there was a lot of people beforehand being like, William and Hussein are great friends. I'm like, they've met each other like twice. What are you on about? You are not friends with someone I've met twice. And clearly they are actually good friends, and everyone's got this inside knowledge that no one shared with me. But I kind of feel like they met each other when William went to Jordan and started talking about football. I'm like, right, we've got to keep in touch.
Yeah.
And they just like are the type of people that were like texting each other during COVID, like, you know, oh, my Aston Villa just lost 5-0. Yeah. And Hussein's like, sucks to be you. My Arabic team has just won 10-0. Yeah. And, you know, that kind of like bromance.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, you know, people say, you're right, that people were saying for years, like, oh, they're best friends and blah, blah, blah. I do think that they say that about everyone who William and Kate meet, that they're best friends with them. And they've got to be right at least once. So this is the one time that they're right. I don't think that necessarily means they're best friends with everybody else. But clearly they do get on very well. And I think I didn't see it actually. I don't know whether I missed it or what happened. But apparently there was a similar one for Sebastian from Luxembourg. And I think that they both went to Sandhurst together.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, so that's
same time as well, I think.
Yes, yeah, so that's kind of must be how they met each other. But that was a very sort of, because Sebastian's quite low down and we, you know, wouldn't normally be sent to represent the Luxembourg royal family all on his own, so clearly there was like a friendship there. So it was just really nice to see Hussein kind of being a bit normal and see the links, I suppose, between different royal families, because Hussein's, I don't, you know, I have issues with Rani and Abdullah that I've spoken about before, but Hussein is his own person and seems like a really nice guy. And I like to see these kind of cross international friendships blossoming.
Yeah, and this always really amused me, because we all know Kit likes to talk, and William and Kate spoke to Rani and Abdullah for like 4 minutes longer than anyone else. But then when they got to this point, everyone's like, oh, Kate's done it again. She's been talking for ages. But no, William spoke for just as long. Just because William had to speak to Hussein and then he spoke to Rajwa, while then Kate, and they had to like do it one by one. They weren't like swapping over. Like, William spoke just as long as Kate did.
Yeah.
They were both just having a full on gossip the whole time they were there, and they were like, whoa, look at your massive train. And, you know, and I was like, no, William is the gossip in this relationship today. This is like William's day out with his bestie Hussein's wedding day. He's having a great time.
Yeah, like later on, there was another receiving line. And I think Kate definitely spoke for a long time at that one, because there was like a gap. So before her, it had been each person in the receiving line had been talking to somebody. And then by the time it got to Kate, there was like a gap between her and William because she'd been talking for so long, she hadn't yet moved on to the next person. But this one in the middle, right after the wedding, she definitely wasn't talking for longer. And she got an unfair, William was like, come on, hurry up. And it's like, you were the one who delayed everything, my dude.
That was a hug, pal, come on.
Justice for Kate, just this once. Yes, so once they'd done the receiving line, I think this is when they did their parade. Yeah, so they don't really have horses and carriages in Jordan in the same way that they do in some of the European royal families. So they do their procession in an open-top car. I don't know what kind of car it is. I think it's a Jeep. Rani and Abdullah did the same for their wedding. And basically they drive around the streets and kind of wave at people. And there's like a military procession behind it. Now, I did tune out for some of this, but the bits that I did see were quite cool. Like their military, there was one bit where they made they all had like colors on them and they made the colors of the Jordanian flag in the procession. And I was like, that is much cooler than just drumming.
Yeah, I really like that part. I remember when it was the coronation and they were like, this is the first time this maneuver's ever been done. And then they just walked around a corner. And I was like, what is the maneuver? Yeah. Like, more flag creation, please. Yeah. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, like when they do the I can't remember what it's called, but there's that big military thing that happens every year. There's something that happens. And I watched it for the first time during the Jubilee year last year, and they set loads of stuff on fire. That was amazing. Loved that. But at actual like coronation processions and things, or Jubilee processions, it is just a lot of marching and playing music. And they don't even play good music. Like, it's all very traditional military music. They're not breaking into Beyonce or something, which would have been quite cool. And I did also notice, like, they didn't have barriers up.
No, people were just very nicely stood in the side of the road.
They had like police there to keep people back. But I mean, I've seen events where Kate's gone to just a normal charity somewhere in London, like a quiet street in London, and they've had to put barriers up there. And that's just a normal charity engagement when about 30 people will show up, but they have to put a barrier as the local police. And so I was just like, wow, how have they not had any incidents? Because, they must just be more dutiful or something. I don't know, because here somebody would definitely try and climb in the carriage and,
throw an egg. Classic.
Yeah, a classic. So I was very impressed that they managed to do that. I like the parade. Yeah.
Why do you always think, like, in a motorcade one, they're like, they have to awkwardly, like, stand up? And I know it's not through a sunroof, but in my head, it looks like they're in a sunroof.
Yeah.
So my brain is just like, that's uncomfortable. Even if they're just like, you know, stood nicely in the back of an open car. I'm like, nope, they are very uncomfy right now.
Yeah, do they stand on the seats? Or do they like stand on a, is there no seats? Do the seats get removed so that they have space to stand? It is very much like when you were younger, and I don't know if you did this, but I always was like, I wish I could just drive and we could be in the car and I could stick my head through the sunroof the whole time. Wouldn't that be really fun? Yeah. But it's like forbidden.
Yeah, in case like my head got chopped off. Well, how that would happen, I don't know. There was nothing above my car to chop my head off. But didn't do it.
It could happen. Or the thing could shut if it was like an electric one.
Yeah, just get you.
Yeah, just chop you in half. Anyway, I don't know why we're talking about that. They didn't get chopped in half. It wasn't even in a sunroof, so it's not relevant. But yes. Yes, it was. It's different, I suppose, from what I'm used to. But, you know, we didn't need to know the names of any of the horses, so that was a relief.
There weren't even any horses.
There weren't even any horses, so we didn't need to know any names. And then they returned to the palace.
This was the first one was the Zaran Palace, which is where the wedding was, and that's where all the big weddings are. And then they went for the other receptions for the Al Husseinia Palace.
Okay, there we go. Al Husseinia Palace. So they went there. And I can't remember the order of where all of these things happened, to be perfectly honest, but there was another receiving line. There might have actually been two more, I think. They cut the cake at one point, but I think there was like basically just a huge musical performance with singing and drums and pipes and fireworks and all sorts of stuff. And it was really amazing, I'm going to say that. It had a really joyful atmosphere, I thought. And you know, we don't get to see the evening parts of the UK weddings. We do get to see the evening parts of like the Scandinavian weddings, for example, but it's usually sort of a sit down dinner with some speeches and some very restrained violin music in the background. We don't get to see like the big performances and stuff like this in quite the same way. So I thought that was really fun to be able to see that. And I got a message, I didn't answer it, but I got a message on Tumblr asking me, sort of saying like, oh, isn't it a bit inappropriate for them to be kind of showing off their wealth and while people are living in poverty. A similar thing to happen with the coronation and every other event ever. And look, first of all, I'm not Jordanian, but I do think that sometimes people can be a bit sort of spoil sports about things like this. So it's possible that Jordanian people are really upset about it. And if that is the case, then that is a valid feeling. But I always think about something like the 2012 Olympics. And in the run up to the 2012 Olympics, all of the articles were about how it was expensive, how it was terribly organized, how it was useless, how it was going to hold up traffic, how nobody was going to be able to get tickets, and how it was just constant negative for ages. And then as soon as the opening ceremony happened, everyone was like, this is the greatest thing in the history of time. This is the best thing that has ever happened to the UK. I love it. I am now obsessed with the Olympics. I watched the Olympics for the first time in 2012. I know a lot of other people did. And a lot of us will have like memories attached for the rest of our lives to the 2012 Olympics. Was it a massive expenditure that maybe we didn't need to do? Sure. But it was also incredibly fun. And so I genuinely am not saying one thing or another about the Jordanian wedding because I do not know how people feel about it. But I just think it's possible that something can be expensive and still be enjoyed by people. Like, it felt to me as an outsider like this massive display and celebration of Jordan and its culture and its people, and I felt like really cheerful coming away from it, and like, isn't, you know, I loved the Jordanian music, and it gave me a good impression of their country as an outsider. So I don't necessarily know that spending a lot of money is always a waste of time, even if you can't physically say this is how much it brought in. Sometimes that doesn't matter. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you're definitely right. And I think like things can do both. Like sometimes you could be like in a perfect world, like, yeah, maybe there wouldn't be a massive discrepancy of wealth between the royal family of Jordan and the average person in Jordan. But that doesn't mean that a big celebration of, you know, love and culture that has reached far more people than any other big celebration of Jordanian culture has done in living, you know, in my memory.
Yeah.
You know, is 100% bad. Like, there can be bad aspects of something or aspects you're not okay with or you don't, you know, feel comfortable with. And then also be like, actually, but these parts have only come from this, and they haven't come from anything else. And I think particularly royal watchers, because most of us, not all of us, are Western, we come from like a very westernized point of view, so northern, you know, USA or European, and we tend to be like, well, we wouldn't like this, or this feels wrong, or it's really awkward. And it's like, well, this is a completely different culture, you know, like, people view things differently and people have different expectations because of how they've grown up. And I think, you know, this is a situation where I can have my opinion on the wedding and whether or not I think it was right or wrong, or they should have spent more or spent less. But at the end of the day, it is up. It's always like, I was thinking about it like with Sweden, when Sweden do things. I'm like, yeah, spend all the money. I literally don't care what you do in Sweden. Give me the biggest party ever, because it does not affect me at all. And it's up to the people of Sweden who decide whether or not it's okay or not. And I think the same thing happened in Jordan. I don't really care if they're having a great big massive party. But if the people of Jordan have got a problem with that, then I'll support them with their problem.
I get very irritated when people are like, you know, during the coronation, we had all these sorts of people being like, well, if who are from the United States, I'll just say it, kind of like hashtag not my king. I mean, duh, obviously he's not your king. But then also saying, you know, like, oh, isn't it regressive and we shouldn't have this and there's no benefits to the monarchy. And if you didn't spend them, and it's like, it's much more complicated than that. There are negatives and there are positives. It's much more complicated. And if we got rid of the monarchy, we wouldn't fix poverty overnight. And that's ridiculous to suggest it. It gets really annoying to me when other people do it to us. So I don't want to do that to other people. So I kind of, until I hear one way or another, which I haven't heard anything positive or negative about the reception in Jordan. So until I hear that, my view is just to take it for what it is. And as an outsider, I felt it was a real celebration. I think there's also a distinction between an event like this and like the one where Queen Rania had a birthday party in the desert and she shipped gallons and gallons of water, and there was a drought in the area, to her birthday party, and it was to dampen the sand. It wasn't even to drink. It was so that she could dampen the sand so that her guests could walk over it. I think that that's an unnecessary expenditure. She could have had her birthday party in her house rather than in the desert, where it was obviously not appropriate. So that was like an extreme expenditure versus like what they've done is actually quite standard for a wedding. But also I think that was a private occasion and this is a state occasion. And so there were guests who were there from all over the world. This was a chance to represent their culture, represent their country. And for a lot of people who are watching, you know, we were watching it at home, and we know people from the United States and people from South America and all sorts of places who were watching this wedding. And for a lot of us, it was the first time we've ever seen a Muslim wedding. It was the first time that we've ever witnessed Jordanian music. And I discovered that they love a good bagpipe, just like Scotland. And so I've never felt such a kindred spirit moment with Jordan ever in my life until this wedding. So again, as we both have said, it's up to Jordanians how they feel about it, but I just don't think that it's automatically a negative thing to spend money on something, even if it doesn't bring in a financial return, because sometimes just having a moment of unity and joyfulness is enough, which I think is very uncharacteristic for me to be saying this. I'm being weirdly positive this episode.
It's like celebration.
Yeah, unity and joyfulness.
But yeah, and also I think you mentioned like it was a state occasion, like, you know, we've had loads of state occasions recently, but prior to the Queen's death, we hadn't had a state occasion in the UK since Charles and Diana's wedding, maybe. Like, we don't have them very often. But for that, like, so, you know, it's almost hard for us to kind of think about it because we don't really see these big state occasions very often. And when we do, they're sort of different and celebratory. But when we're going over to Jordan, like, a lot of it is, you know, invited diplomats and, you know, invited royals and heads of state from other countries. And you do want to put on a show when you're bringing over people who can benefit your country, because, you know, royal weddings are not just royal weddings. They're also, look how great our country is. Please send us some oil. You know, it's also that. So, of course, they're going to put on a show. They're not going to be like, come and sit in a cold room and look sad, because that is more appropriate for the people on the internet.
Yeah, yeah, ridiculous. And so then after whatever we just talked about, after the sort of celebration part, there was another receiving line, I think. I think this was the fourth receiving line, and they had to receive everybody. So there was 1,400 people at reception. So they had to they had to say hello to all 1,400 people, which I think is incredible. And we got tiaras.
Yes.
So it's quite rare for the Jordanian royals to wear tiaras at all. Like, we've seen Rania and tiaras like five times or something. It's a very small. It just isn't part of. She didn't wear one for her wedding. You know, it's just not part of how they do things generally. So we weren't sure if we were going to have tiaras. We did hear in advance some stories that we would. We didn't know exactly when, but we not only saw like tiaras, but we saw them from like everybody. So all of the Jordanian royal women were wearing tiaras, which is an incredibly rare sight. But then all of the European royals also were wearing, and, you know, some of the others were wearing tiaras as well. So it was a big show of tiaras in the evening.
Yeah, it was like, we kind of knew there were going to be tiaras at some point, and then they didn't come at the wedding, and then there was a reception but there were no tiaras, and everyone's like, what, we've been lied to? And then Everyone's like, oh wait, there must be another reception, because These aren't proper people. No offense to the people who were there,
like, the Middleton family.
No offense, Middletons. These are just normal people. These aren't your royals and your heads of state. So There had to be something else coming. And then I was sort of sat outside, and I was outside the cinema, and I'd seen the pictures of the Dutch royals and the Swedish royals, and everyone's like, come on, Kate, we've got to do stuff. And I was like, yeah, I've got to go to the cinema. And then I ended up going in to watch a film, and every now and then I just think, Kate's probably wearing a tiara right now, and I don't know what it is. Trying to watch a film.
To be honest, it took so long for pictures to come out that you could have watched the whole film and come out and not known. Because for some reason,
I came out and I was like, what was it?
Yeah. What did you watch?
Across the Spider-Verse.
Oh, fun. Yes.
Yeah,
I've heard good things. Anyway, yeah, so there was lots of tiaras. I think most of the royals wore tiaras that we've either seen before or that are just, yeah, their standard tiaras that they always wear. So there was a lot, wasn't a lot of exciting stuff, although I did pick out a couple of exciting moments. So one was Princess Amalia, who's the heir to the throne of the Netherlands, who wore, I mean, it depends on how you think about it. So either it was her second tiara, because it was, she wore her tiara for her 18th birthday, this little star tiara, or it was her third, because she, as a child, wore the one of the ruby tiaras that the royal family has in a very cute photograph. She was just in her mother's dressing room and they put a tiara on her. So it's maybe her third tiara, if you want to think about it that way, which is quite, and she wore the ruby peacock tiara for the first time, which is quite impressive because she's only 19.
Yeah, she's rattling through it. She's like, I'm doing them all. I'm wearing every tiara going.
By the time she turns 20, if we consider this the third tiara, she's already worn more tiaras, or she's worn the same number of tiaras as Kate's worn. So by the age of 20, she's probably going to be ahead of Kate.
She's just going for it. And I love it because we know she likes tiaras. And I just like to imagine they're like, do you watch her? Do you want to wear? Do you want to wear your 18th birthday tiara? And she's like, no. Let me have a look. I'm going to pick one that is a perfect match. And she's like, obviously, this is the exact right one because of these many reasons that no one else would ever think about.
Yeah, so in her 18th birthday, they did a book about her, which is a very standard Dutch thing. They always release a book about the heir. And in that, she shared some facts about herself. She did some interviews and she said that she was a big tiara fan. So we know that she's a total nerd about it. And so I'm sure it was so excited. And she did look beautiful. It worked really beautifully with the gown. She looked fantastic. So that was one of my things that I observed. It's not my favorite tiara, but I think it's notable that she was wearing it at all, because it just, you know, normally when a royal gets a tiara, they get like in the Swedish royal family, get these ugly tiny little ones for their 18th and they wear those for a little while and then they start to get access to the other tiaras, so that was quite fun. The other big thing I think was Princess Beatrice wearing a tiara. So she obviously wore one for her wedding. It's not the first time she's worn a tiara, but it's the first time she's worn one outside of a wedding context where loads of brides wear tiaras. And she wore the York tiara, which hasn't been seen in well over 20 years. I don't know exactly how long, but a long time, which was her mother's tiara for her wedding. And it's her personal property, so she got to keep it. So, yeah, that was quite significant, was to get to see Beatrice, because I think a lot of us had thought that because she's not a working royal, obviously they didn't have tiaras at the coronation, we might never, ever see her in a tiara again, or not for a very long time. And then she was like, surprise.
Yeah, and I think, you know, before Beatrice and Eugenie got married, we were like, are they both going to wear the York tiara? Yeah. Like, and then neither of them did. So we were like, okay, but never see the York tiara again. Then Sarah can sell it to pay off some debts. But no, clearly, they've kept it. And, you know, the York girls can, it's their family tiara rather than being a royal family tiara. So they can just pop it on whenever.
Yeah, exactly. I think that makes, I mean, obviously, I think it looked beautiful on Beatrice. It really suited her. It's probably a lot easier for her to not have to go to the royal family and be like, hey guys, can I please borrow one of your tiaras and take it to the Middle East? It's probably a lot easier. Although that is a question I have, is like, somebody mentioned this the other day and I've never really thought about it. Like, how do they travel with them? Victoria and Daniel went on a commercial plane.
Yeah, and we saw William and Kate coming out of the airport into the hotel.
Yeah.
And no one is carrying a tiara box.
No.
Like, I'm looking at this footage of the luggage and I'm like, where is the tiara?
Do you think they send them ahead of time?
Yeah, I think they must send them like in advance, like courier style, like drive them across the country. Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe there's a special secret company that only rich people know about that like transports jewels. Because I think about like the insurance cost. I'm sure that you have to, like, they, whenever I book a flight, they're always like, do you want to buy insurance for what you're taking with you? And it's like, it covers you for up to like a grand or something. It's like, I don't think that would quite work for a 100-year-old tiara in the British royal family or something.
Yeah, there's got to be like special mega rich jewelry insurers who are like,
yeah,
have you got more than 7 diamonds on here? Yes. Okay, right, you're gonna have to go to our premium tier.
Yeah, you could obviously take a tiara on an RAF plane. Obviously we didn't see it, but you could do if you wanted to. But how did it, like, did she just have it in her hand luggage? Like, do you have to take that out for security? Yeah.
Like, what's in the box, ma'am? I was like, nice hat.
Yeah. It's just a headpiece. But yes, yeah, so there was a lot of tiaras, lots of things that we're quite used to seeing. But yeah, I think there were a couple of those notable moments, which was quite nice.
And I think, you know, you had obviously the European royals in their like go-to classic tiaras, just like your average. And then you had a lot of the sort of Jordanian and Arabic royals in, you know, like their first tiaras, or, you know, or their wedding tiaras, because that's the only tiaras everyone ever worn. And then you had like these real like the Sheikahs, like the Sheikah of Qatar and the Sheikah and like Sheikah Muna of Kuwait. And they were just like, no, we are just going to go full traditional and wear a veil, and looked equally stunning.
Oh, Moza was like amazing. Moza, the of Qatar, she's, her husband used to be the head of state of Qatar. She wore this like neon green gown with the headscarf was built into the gown. It was one of the coolest things. I mean, I don't think she's a very good, I think she might be one of the corrupt ones, I'm not 100% sure, but she's got fantastic style.
I don't know if I'm good. That's really pretty. Are you, I don't know anything about you, so I can't like be too positive, but you look great.
It was just a really, I think obviously the wedding is the important part and like the love and blah, 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 but the fashion was great.
Ah, but there was a piece of fashion in this end of celebration that was not great, which was Rajwa's second wedding dress.
Yeah, I did not even write that down.
I did write that down. That was so much worse than her first one.
Yeah, I saw even the people who had decided that Rajwa was the greatest human being alive for absolutely no reason, even they were kind of like, well, it's not my favourite. like even they couldn't ignore that. I think, so if you haven't seen it, it's by Dolce & Gabbana, and it looks like if you've ever squirted cream, you know, use the sort of cream in a can, squirty cream, or shaving foam, and you just put a bit out and it's kind of gone over everywhere. That's what it was.
Yeah, it was like opera gloves,
yeah,
cap sleeves, squirty cream. It was a look, an entire look. And yeah, also it was Dolce & Gabbana, so everyone was like, oh, we can't even defend that. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was cracking.
It was not my favourite. I mean, in a way, I kind of appreciated it just for, I didn't hate it as much as everybody else, I think, just because it was so 90s. And kind of camp, and I kind of felt like at least it was I feel like they executed what they'd written down. It's not a good dress, it's objectively not a good dress, but I at least appreciated that like they clearly did what they set out to do. Whereas with the Ely Saab thing, it was better ideas, better components, but it just felt like they hadn't really thought about it as much. It didn't feel like a concept, I suppose, that was fully realized. So I'm gonna, you know, maybe I'm just being contrarian as always, but I do think that the evening gown was horrible, but at least it was kind of, it gave me some camp and some theater.
It did remind me a bit of Rania's wedding dress.
Yes.
So I went, just took a picture and was like, you see this, make this, but like somehow different.
Somehow, yeah.
100%, we know exactly what you mean. Get the opera gloves out, guys. We've got this.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, sometimes you've just got to respect an ugly dress.
Yes. You've got to respect an ugly dress. Yes, I like that.
So that is all we have got for this week. Hope you enjoyed it. It was very nice to look at a wedding and look at a wedding from a different culture, mm-hmm, and look at some dresses and be pleasant and also contrary, all about all the things at once. But I hope you enjoy it. If you do, and even if you don't, please like us 5 stars everywhere you listen to any podcast ever. And we will return in time.
No, because who knows what's going on?
At some point, could be next week, might not be, no one knows.
Ooh, the mystery.
But until that point, good, it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.